Hello, I'm Tom Weber. Thanks for listening to NPR News here on the radio or online or on our podcast. We're going to focus this hour on a few items in the news in Washington that definitely have ramifications here in Minnesota. One of them is that a member, as you just heard Stephen John note in the newscast, there, a member of the Minnesota Supreme Court is testifying in his confirmation hearing right now to become a federal judge. That's David Strauss. We will hear about him later. But first, you've also heard this morning, including from Nina Totenberg on Morning Edition, about the Supreme Court arguments over privacy in the digital age. Do police need a search warrant to look at cell phone location data? This is a big case that could have big ramifications. Police tracked cell phone data of a man they later arrested for robbing electronic stores in Michigan and Ohio, but they didn't get a warrant to track those data. They got a court order under a different law, which we'll talk about. University of Minnesota Law School professor Bill McGovern follows privacy issues in the news and joins me now. Good to see you again. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me. Good morning.
I'd love to hear your thoughts as well as we listen to Bill here. When you give your information to corporations like a wireless provider, do you expect that the government would have access to that? Are you okay with that in the name of public safety? What are your thoughts on this case? 1-800-242-2828. 651-227-6000. You can tweet me at WeberTom1, and don't call or text if you're driving. There is a Minnesota law that we'll get into in a little bit, Bill, but let's just start off here with some of the issues, some of the juicy stuff you like to dive into when you think about the law ramifications here.
So you're right. There is a Minnesota law that goes further, but the case the Supreme Court is hearing, just finished hearing a few minutes ago, actually, is about the Fourth Amendment to the federal United States Constitution, mm-hmm. and whether it requires the police to get a warrant before they get this kind of information. What happened here is they went to the phone companies, the wireless carriers mm-hmm. of these suspects, and got the information. And under doctrine that's been around since the 1970s, it's called the third party doctrine. The idea is, once you've surrendered the information to somebody else, the police are free to go get it from those third parties, and you don't no longer have any privacy interest in that. Mm-hmm. But in recent years, the Supreme Court has increasingly questioned whether that fits our current technology, and this is the latest and most important case in that series.
And there was a series of armed robberies of these stores. This guy was the ringleader. Right. At some point, they caught one of the lower echelon.
Exactly. They turned him, right?
And so they said, go find this guy. And so it wasn't as if they only had those cell phone records, but it sounds like being able to show, hey, here are these cell phone records. This guy was in these places right at the time these stores were being robbed, that was the nail in the coffin.
Right. It was pretty important evidence. But you're right that one of the ironies of this case, I think, is that if the police had sought a warrant saying we have probable cause to believe this person is a suspect, they probably would have got one.
Yeah.
And, you know, warrants are not necessarily that difficult to get against people where you really have some evidence already.
Because you have a guy who says this is the guy.
His underling pointed to him and gave, where did the police get the phone number? From the underling. So they knew and they had probable cause. They just didn't get the warrant. And so in serious cases where it would be really helpful, police still would be able to get a warrant even if the Supreme Court rules for Carpenter in this case.
Why does it matter? Why does it matter if cell phone records are out there and pretty easy to get already? Why go the step of needing that warrant? What does that mean?
So two reasons, I think. One is that the standard is this probable cause standard that's an ancient standard from, you know, before the founders. And it's evolved over time, but we have a really good understanding of what it is. And it kind of requires that the cops can't go on fishing expeditions. Can't just say, you know, let's look into that Tom Weber guy and see if he's mm-hmm. been up to something and go get the records. They have to connect you to some real articulable suspicion of a crime. And that the second reason it's important is that the warrants, the judges are overseeing them actively, and the judges can put conditions or limitations in them, say they can only go for a certain time or only go to certain places.
This gets into the digital age then too, Bill. As we talked to Bill McGovern here from the U of M. There's so much we could talk about here, Bill. This goes off into so many directions. We'd love to invite your questions as well, 1-800-242-2828. When police are investigating a crime, right? So let's say, and I heard this posed in The Daily, which is the New York Times podcast the other day. If there had been someone on the street corner watching that store get robbed, the police would not have needed a warrant to go talk to that person and say, hey, what'd you see? Did you notice that guy? Oh, yeah, that was Carpenter. They would not have needed a warrant. And so the argument is that that cell phone tower is the same thing in practice, right?
Right. And that's exactly where the doctrine, this third-party rule, comes from, right? It started with turncoats. It's actually originally in a case involving Jimmy Hoffa, an associate of his who started giving information about him. So, indeed, the police don't need a warrant to talk to this underling in Carpenter's gang and ask him questions about what did you see, what do you know, and even use the leverage of having possible charges against him. Mm-hmm. The question is where we draw the line. So, as technology has increased, and this isn't just about cell phones that indicate your location. It's about all kinds of other technological assistance, other GPS tracking, license plate readers that have been in the news here in Minnesota in recent years, and all of these different surveillance technologies that go way beyond the capacity of an ordinary observer on the street. But if you make the analogy between an eyewitness and a machine and say they're the same, then that's how you get to where the doctrine's got us to now.
So what's the argument for that? No, you absolutely need a warrant in this case.
The argument is that the scale and magnitude of not just the happenstance that one person observed Carpenter going to one place, but that the police got 126 days, I think, of his cell phone records, which were not only who he called and when, but where he was standing at each of those times, because the records include whatever's the tower, the cell phone antenna that handled your call. So, and also the reason this case is important is, although in this case they only got the records of his calls, actually our cell phones are very frequently pinging to see where there's a nearby tower, like to refresh apps in the background or do other things. So it could even be not just when you made calls, but everywhere you
just
were
sitting there, because these robberies actually took place 7 years ago. You think about how long ago, how much cell phones have
Absolutely.
Come along. So literally you are sitting here and we put your phone in the other room because we didn't want it ringing. But right now your phone, while you're sitting here doing this interview, is telling the world, or at least that phone company, information about you.
There's a good chance it is. It's telling the phone, one of my social media apps in the background refreshes to get new status updates, it has to do that by talking to an antenna, and the phone company knows where that antenna is.
So, and when we buy a phone, we never think about that.
I don't, and I study this stuff.
So this is interesting, as we talk to Bill McGivern here, because as you know, as we come into the digital age, the court has had to weigh in a couple times on some of this stuff. In 2012, the court ruled that if police use a GPS tracking device to monitor someone, they need a search warrant. In 2014, they ruled that if you seize a smartphone at the time of an arrest, hey, I have your cell phone now in my hand, I need a warrant to open up the phone and look what's on it. So this is the next case in that series.
Exactly. And in each of those cases, they tried to say, well, we're only talking about this specific circumstance. But as more and more of these cases come up, it's getting harder and harder. And people are wondering if this is the time the Supreme Court is going to try and step back and articulate a new, more general rule that would be applicable to all the technology that might be involved.
How have courts and our laws in the history, going back to the founders, addressed the theory behind I need to look in people's houses sometimes or in their pockets to see if they've committed a crime?
Well, the centerpiece of it has traditionally always been a warrant. When the founders wrote that warrant language into the Fourth Amendment, that's what they had in mind. They said if someone's going to come in and look at your papers or search your home, search your person, that they needed to get this judicial authorization from what's called a detached, neutral magistrate. And that's been the consistent rule since the founding. The question is, when are things not situations that are going to your privacy that are technically searches, so that warrant rule doesn't apply? And throughout the 20th century, basically, the court gradually started saying, well, when you put your garbage out on the curb for the trash collector to take it, you're surrendering your garbage so the cops can look in it. Mm-hmm. Well, when you are writing a check, you're telling your bank where you're sending money, so it's okay for the law enforcement to go ask your bank where you're sending money. When you make a phone call, you're telling the phone company what numbers you're dialing so they know who you call so they're allowed to tell the police. And at each of those steps, of course, as more and more of our life is in the hands of these third parties, as we get increasingly digital and connected, there's more and more situations like that where some company knows about our finances, our movements, our preferences, our web browsing, whatever it might be. And the police have increasingly had more and more access to all of that without that warrant.
There's also the idea of using the warrant. I'm reading this from an NPR story that says the Supreme Court has usually stuck with a framework that was adopted about 40 years ago that distinguishes, that makes, that does draw that line between something that is in your home or your car or something that is out in the open shared with others. So you mentioned the garbage, it's on the street. Yes, you can go rummage through it, but if you want to come into my house and look in my garbage can, you need a warrant. So how do you differentiate between whether it's in my home or my car or in my pocket, but it is a cell phone that is regularly talking with third parties? How do you draw that line?
It's really, really difficult. That's why it's really important and why people look at this case. But, you know, as much as the home has always been the core, the home, your home and your body are sort of your absolute core where you definitely have privacy. And then as you move out to other settings like your car and other, and, you know, riding on public trains or whatever, it gradually gets less and less private. On the other hand, courts, the Supreme Court and lower courts have been doing this for a long time, right? They've decided that the content of your email messages, even if they're seized someplace outside of your own home computer in your house, require a warrant. They did this cell phone case where they decided, even though you're out in public, indeed you're under arrest, that they can't open your cell phone's content without getting a warrant. And again, if you're under arrest, they have probable cause. They can get that warrant. But the idea is that it should be under supervision. It shouldn't be the kind of thing where a police officer can just open and start scrolling through your contents, your text messages, your, you know, the lists you keep in there, all of your social media connections, that was so much information and not allowed.
Have you found examples so far as we navigate this path of where we've already contradicted ourselves, either in the laws we pass or in the way that courts see this and rule on this?
Yeah, so there's a lot of sort of wacky wrinkles in trying to adjust to the new technology. I mean, but we haven't mentioned yet, but both the Minnesota State Legislature and Congress also get involved and add another whole layer of rules. So, for example, there's really strict rules for looking at your emails as long as they're new. But after they're about 6 months old, the rules get less strict. And that's left over from a time when you were getting your email on these slow dial-up connections, and you surely downloaded and read everything that was important. And if you left something, you know, in your email inbox for more than 6 months, that meant it wasn't important.
Well,
you know, these days, that's, I always tell my students, it's the exact reverse, right? My old messages that I haven't deleted yet are the important ones.
Exactly.
But the rule is based on old technology.
So what is, let's dive into, and we hope you'll call up with your questions and observations as well. 1-800-242-2828, 651-227-6000. When you give your information to a corporation like a wireless phone company, do you expect the government would then have access to that, a.k.a. the police? Are you okay with that in the name of public safety? 1-800-242-2828. I'm going to turn to state laws, and then I'm going to take a call from someone I think you might know, Bill, because I think he helped you or has worked on these. But Minnesota's law gets into this cell phone location data issue as well. What does Minnesota say?
It does. So as this technology increased and a lot of advocates were pointing out that this was a problem, indeed, as Carpenter's case was working its way through the courts, the Minnesota legislature a few years ago, I think 2014, passed a statute that said at the state level, they can't control federal authorities, but at the state level, Minnesota law enforcement does need to get a warrant in the situation like Carpenter. And since the law, there was a study that came out kind of at the end of last year. So in the first 2 years, there were about 2,000 of those warrants in the state. But they need to get the permission from the court just as they would in other, like if they were searching your house.
So if Carpenter had been robbing stores in Minnesota, more recently since right. this law passed.
And being investigated by state, not federal officials.
See, that's the thing, right? So if the Minneapolis or St. Paul police were investigating, they would have needed the warrant, which, again, you said probably in this case would have been easy to get because they'd already gotten the guy to turn in the other case. But if it had been the federal marshals for some reason investigating him, it's a different set of rules.
Yes, that's right. And that's another layer of complexity.
So is the Minnesota law on the line here with this case?
Not necessarily, because what the Supreme Court is deciding is it's saying, regardless of what laws say, does the Constitution demand that law enforcement get a warrant? And if they find that about the federal Constitution, then that will apply to all law enforcement in all states, federal, state, local.
But if they rule that there is no warrant needed,
then they'll be saying the Constitution doesn't require it, but Minnesota's state legislature, correct, having decided that they're going to impose it, would still be all right. It just wouldn't be that the Constitution forced their hand.
I see.
So it's like the Constitution's the trump card. But if the Constitution, but if the Constitution says you don't need a warrant, Congress and state legislatures can still pass rules regulating the cops, as they always do.
They could still pass it. It's just not because the Fourth Amendment.
Right. It's not constitutionally required.
Well, Rich Neumeister is in St. Paul, who works a lot on open records and open meetings issues as well. He's pretty active on Twitter as well. And Rich, you're on the phone here, and you wanted to get in on this. I know you've been involved in the Minnesota debate as well. So welcome to NPR. Thanks for calling in.
Thank you very much, Mr. McGivern and Mr. Weber. You know, just a couple observations, and I'd like to hear how Mr. McGivern responds to it. One of the things over the years, and particularly my involvement over the decades on privacy and law enforcement technologies, is law enforcement is not going to knock on the door of the legislature and say, hey, we need to update our laws. You know, and that was one of the things that myself and one or two other folks found out about the Stingray. This was a device that cost lots of money that can track very specifically where you are by the phone that you have in your pocket. Well, the legislature, you know, the BCA didn't knock on the door of the legislature and tell them, hey, we got this device and we need a probable cause standard, which is the standard for Fourth Amendment. They were under an old law, which they could get an order real easy. So my question is, Mr. McGivern, how do you see how the public can find out about these things? Because like law enforcement's not going to knock on the door, and technology is changing so dang fast. And secondly, with our current law, when I was, you know, intimately lobbying, talking to folks on this, particularly with folks on the other side, the Minnesota law enforcement did not want search warrant in there, which a lot of states have for these kind of stuff. They wanted tracking warrant. So the issue comes into play in discussion since the law has changed. Is there really Fourth Amendment protections here in Minnesota because it's called a tracking warrant instead of a search warrant? And because of the case laws and those kinds of things. If you could go into that a little bit, that would be very helpful for, I think, a lot of listeners.
I didn't know there was a difference.
Well, it's as Rich suggests, so to the first question, how do we deal with these things? Thank goodness for Rich and the American Civil Liberties Union and lots of advocates that kind of bring these things up. And then, of course, you have a debate where the law enforcement and advocates come to before the legislature and kind of, you know, the legislature brokers what they think is the best solution. In that example, the legislature did say you have to have a warrant and did apply the standards of the similar kind of a warrant that you would get under the Fourth Amendment, but they gave it this different name.
The tracking
warrant. And then there's a further wrinkle, which is the Star Tribune and Fox 9 reported at the end of last year that even though that law required there to be sort of a disclosure and transparency about these warrants so we could have further policy discussion about it, all of them basically have been sealed for various reasons. They've said, this needs to still be kept under wraps. And so it's very difficult to actually understand exactly. We know the number of them. We know there's about 2,000 of them in that two-year period. But we don't know a lot more about what the standards were behind them. And I've suggested to some legislators that that's something that's worth looking into now.
Why should we care? Why should we care about any of this?
Well, we care for two reasons. One is this is ultimately about government power. right? And this is a restraint or a check on law enforcement's power. The warrant requirement means that the law enforcement has to give its reasons and has to come forward with some evidence. And I think that's valuable just as a way of making sure it's not unchecked policing power. And the second reason we should care is that fishing expeditions would be a particular abuse of that power, right? So if law enforcement, and, you know, unfortunately in our country's history at times in the past, we've seen this, right, where the government has an axe to grind against somebody and starts investigating them for all kinds of things as a way of trying to silence them or marginalize them.
Well, I mean, Martin Luther King was wiretapped.
Absolutely. All of the abuses in the COINTELPRO era in the 1960s and 70s are definitely hang over this. And we don't want that to happen. We don't want that to happen again. And robust warrant requirements are one of the real stalwart ways of preventing that.
Dennis in Woodbury called with a question about, what about after an accident? Can officers access phone data to see if the person responsible was texting? Which we do know they do because we hear about that. We say we believe the person was texting at the time of the crash, which is illegal. Nobody should do it. Nobody calling this show should be calling while they're driving either. But go ahead.
That's right. Well, so you can take evidence at the scene of an accident, and that would include potentially, if you think that, seizing and immobilizing the cell phone until such a time as you get a warrant to look inside it.
Oh, so it would still be the warrant thing. So absolutely, yes, police do look to see if you were texting at the time, but they have to get a warrant to do so.
Under most circumstances, that would be true. There's emergency exceptions mm-hmm. to the warrant requirement, but as long as so in that cell phone case at the Supreme Court, which Chief Justice Roberts wrote the opinion and was unanimous, he sort of said, you've arrested this person, there's no immediate threat. If you're afraid someone's going to erase the data remotely, you can put the phone in a special bag that isolates it from signals, and then just go get the warrant. And so I think it would probably be the same there.
Another comment online notes that when these phones are talking to the tower, it's not just one tower, that it's usually multiple towers. And so there's actually a lot of good technology. It's not just that you're in this circular, if you think of where the tower is and you draw the radius, you're not anywhere in that dot. You have this triangulation and you get really good at knowing where people are.
That's exactly right. And it's gotten better and better over time. It's much better now than it was when the law enforcement authorities got the data from Carpenter.
What about when you're in danger and you want the police to track you? I think we saw that video of the drone with the night vision somewhere in Minnesota where the kid had wandered off and the dog, everyone loved this video because
right.
the dog stayed with the kid. I don't think that kid was necessarily carrying a cell phone, but you could easily translate that into an episode where, please track me so you can find me. Where does that lie into
right.
all of this?
But so an emergency, there's already lots of, that's why I like going back to the warrant requirement actually, because over centuries, we've built exceptions up. There's an exigent circumstances exception to the warrant requirement. It would clearly be applicable there.
So that it just says this is an emergency. We're going to turn on Bill's phone.
Right. For the welfare of the person.
For the
involved.
Welfare of Bill. We got to find him.
Right.
Let's go find that stuff. Let's go back to the phones here. Tyler in Minneapolis. What would you like to add and ask here? Tyler, thanks for calling.
Hi, thanks. It sounds like you have some great input. I think courts have usually used the measurement of the benefit to the public and weighing that against the impact to the individual and the invasion of privacy. Obviously, it's going to be different to go into someone's home than it is to, you know, as you mentioned, search through their trash on the outside. How does that, you know, the weighing of public benefit versus individual harm and invasion of privacy weigh into this decision?
Yeah, so the traditional warrant requirement is from an old case now in the 1960s, the reasonable expectation of privacy. You've probably heard that phrase. And that includes reasonable, meaning what is society prepared to recognize? You know, if you want to be a hermit and want to have a degree of privacy that is out of balance with societal needs or law enforcement needs, the court's going to say that's not reasonable. And so that's the way that it's built into the very core of the warrant requirement. So you have to be expecting privacy, but also society has to be willing to recognize that that's an appropriate place for privacy to be respected.
Where does this go? Where do you think this case will land? We've seen a couple cases here about technology that say you do need the warrant, but there are all these other. Right. Where do you think they're going to land?
Well, so the two opinions you mentioned earlier about the GPS and about the arrestee's cell phone were 9-0 opinions for warrants.
Wow.
And there were opinions written by Justice Alito and Chief Justice Roberts suggesting that they were moving in that direction. So there's a pretty broad view on the Supreme Court. We don't know about Justice Gorsuch yet, but there's a pretty broad view of the other eight justices that we need to fix this. And the hot takes on Twitter immediately after the argument within the last hour have suggested the questioning seemed to point in that direction this morning as well. But the real question, and this was in your questions a little bit earlier, Tom, is not, is this particular case resolved that way, but does the court do a good job of pointing us towards a real new standard for, so we can predict not just this morning's case, but the next one, and the next one as technology develops. And that's going to be a taller order. We'll see if they manage to do it in this case.
I mean, we talk about frameworks, the test. Does this pass this test or that test?
Right.
I don't even know what that would look like in this age of technology changing all the darn time. Maybe they don't build a new entire framework. They just continue to do this case by case.
Well, they could do that, but that leaves police in a difficult position of having to sort of make it up as they go along. And as some people have pointed out, probably just go ahead and get warrants to be safe.
Right.
So it would be better if they came up with a framework. And certainly a lot of law professors are busy drafting up their suggestions and have been for a long time what that framework should be. I mean, one way of looking at it is to say, what does this deliver to the police? How detailed and broad of a picture does this deliver to the police? And if it's too much, then you say, got a warrant. You know, if this is not just like looking at a few pages of my diary, but looking at a video of my life for a year, that's a difference of degree that's so big it starts to become a difference in kind.
Well, it's the difference of using the technology to know that I was standing on that corner versus knowing exactly what I was texting at the time, too.
That's exactly right.
That's one of those walls, too. In our final minute here, Bill, we're going to be moving after the news break to a conversation about David Strauss, a Minnesota Supreme Court justice who's up for a federal judgeship. And he taught at the University of Minnesota Law School and I believe was a colleague of yours. So I wanted to bring you in because I think you were part of the effort of support to say he should be a federal judge. I want to get your thoughts. And obviously you have an opinion on this, but I just wanted to get your thoughts since you're part of this story in a way.
Yeah. So I helped organize a letter of all the people who have been colleagues of Justice Strauss when he was a professor with us at the University of Minnesota Law School and most of the faculty across the whole ideological spectrum signed the letter saying that we think he's fair-minded, he's open-minded, he's fiendishly smart, and he really loves the law. And I definitely do not agree personally with a lot of decisions that Justice Strauss might reach or has reached on the Minnesota Supreme Court. But he's really qualified, and he's often unpredictable, and I think that means he's open-minded. So I'm supportive.
And to what you didn't say, what you kind of said, is that you and him are on the different sides of the political.
I have an Al Franken bumper sticker on my minivan, and he does not.
He's very right-leaning.
He was a clerk for Justice Thomas. He's a member of the Federalist Society. He's definitely a more conservative-type thinker. But the important word there is that he is a thinker.
Bill McGovern, it's always interesting when you come in. It's very cool to talk to you, and thanks for coming in. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.